The Beauty and Mystery of Providence by Hugh Bining, 1627 to 1653. Hugh Bining's light burned brightly, but briefly. He excelled in his studies, and although his weak constitution would not allow him to study continually, he seemed to retain nearly everything he read. He served as the minister of the parish of Govan near Glasgow, only 4 years before dying of tuberculosis at the age of 26. This sermon, the second in a series of 18, is from Heart Humiliation. It elegantly expresses his sweeping grasp of doctrine. He is the rock. His work is perfect. For all his ways are judgment, a God of truth, and without iniquity, just and right is he. They have corrupted themselves. Their spot is not the spot of his children. Deuteronomy 32, verses 4 through 5. There are none that can behold their own vileness as it is, unless it is in the sight of God's glorious holiness. Sin is darkness, and neither sees itself nor anything else. Therefore, his light must shine in to discover this darkness. If we abide in ourselves, and men like ourselves, we cannot wisely judge ourselves. Our dim sparkle will not make all the imperfections and spots appear. But if men would come forth into the presence of his majesty, he who turns darkness into light, and before whom hell is naked, oh, how base and vile would they appear in their own eyes. Is it any wonder that the multitude of you see not yourselves, when holy Isaiah and Job had this lesson to learn? Isaiah gets a discovery of his own uncleanness in the sight of God's glorious holiness, Isaiah 6 verse 5, which I think made all his former light darkness. He cries out, "Unclean," as if he had never known it before. And so Job, "Since I saw thee, I abhorred myself in dust and ashes." Job 42, verse 6. You hear much of him, and it does not abase you. But if you saw him, you would not abide yourselves. You would prefer the dust you tread on to yourselves. You who know most know that there is a mystery of iniquity in your hearts that is not yet discerned. You are merely on the coast of that bottomless sea of abomination and vileness. Among all the aggravations of sin, nothing so demonstrates the folly, yea, the madness of it, as the perfection, goodness, and absolute unspottedness of God. It is this that takes away all pretense of excuse and leaves nothing to the same. There is no place in which to hide its confusion, nakedness, and shame. And therefore, when Moses would convince his people of their ways and make them inexcusable, he draws the parallel of God's ways and their ways, declares what God is, how absolutely perfect he is in himself and in his works, who had given no cause of provocation to them to depart from him. And then how odious must their departing be when both are painted on a canvas before their eyes. It makes sin become exceedingly sinful. When the Lord would pierce the hearts of his people and engrave a challenge with the point of a diamond, he uses this as his pen. Have I been a wilderness unto Israel, a land of darkness? Why say my people, "We are lords, we will come no more to thee"? Jeremiah 2 verse 31. What iniquity have your fathers found in me, that they are gone far from me and have walked after vanity? And that's verse 5. There are two things in sin that exceedingly abuse the creature: the iniquity of it, and the folly and madness of it. It is contrary to all equity and reason to depart from him that has made us and given us a law, to whom we are by so many obligations tied. But what is the folly and madness of departing from the fountain of living waters to dig broken cisterns that can hold none? Verse 13. This is a thing that the heavens may be astonished at. And if the earth had sense to understand such a thing, the whole fabric of it would tremble with horror at such madness and folly of reasonable souls. And this evil has two evils in it. We forsake life and love death. We go from him and choose vanity. It is great iniquity to depart without an offense on his part. He may appeal to all our consciences and let them sit down and examine his way most narrowly. What iniquity have you found in me? What cause have you to leave me? Jeremiah 2, verse 5. But when, nevertheless, he is a living fountain, he is our glory. He is a fruitful land, a land of light, our ornament and attire. In a word, our life and our consolation, our happiness and our beauty. What word shall be found to express the extreme madness of men to depart from such a one and change their glory into that which does not profit? If either he were not a fountain of living waters, or if there were any other fountain that could yield water to satisfy the insatiable desires of men, it would be more excusable. But what shadow shall be found to cover such an iniquity that is both infinite sin and an incomparable loss? It is the Scripture's style given to natural men, fools and simple. All sin has folly in it, but departing from God, besides iniquity, has the extremity of folly in it, because they embrace a dunghill instead of a throne. They make the maddest exchange that can be imagined: glory for shame, life for death, and consolation and peace for vanity, vexation, and anguish of spirit. If you would be duly affected with the sight of your own evils, look upon them in this light, and in the view of God, your large portion. You will be forced to confess that you yourselves are beasts in his sight. Psalm 73, verse 22. Oh, that men would consider how good and blessed the Lord is, how he is alone, and that there is nothing beside him in heaven and earth. All are broken cisterns. All is dung and unprofitable. All is vanity and vexation. Only he is sufficient. All others are insufficient. And therefore, he is a proportioned good for our necessity and desires. And I am sure you would be constrained to cry out with David, "Whom have I in heaven but thee, or in the earth beside thee? It is good for me to draw near to God." Psalm 73, verse 28. You would look on drawing near and walking with him and before him, not only as the most reasonable thing, but as the best thing, most beautiful for you, most profitable for you, and all other ways would be looked on as the ways of death. His work is perfect. Deuteronomy 32, verse 4. The Lord looked, and behold, all was good that was made. And so it was at first. The fabric of this world was an exquisite and perfect work, a suitable demonstration of his infinite wisdom, wonderful in all the parts of it, and in the unity and harmony of the whole. But so also his work of providence is perfect. Divine wisdom has framed and contrived everything, and it cannot be better. If anything seems imperfect in itself, yet it is perfect in relation to the glorious ends that he directs it unto. And so would we look on all the works among us. If anything seemed a spot and disgrace of the creation, certainly the sin of men and angels, even that is so ordered by his holy sovereignty, that in relation to his majesty, it may be called a perfect work. If you would but consider what a glorious high throne he has erected to himself for justice and judgment, to be the habitation of it, and mercy and truth to go before it, upon the ruins of defaced man. What a theater of justice he has erected upon the angel's fall. You would call it as perfect a work as is in the world. His work is one in the world, subordinate to one great design of manifesting his own glorious justice, mercy, omnipotency, and wisdom. Now what do you see of it but parcels? Though you comprehend all your time in one thought, yet certainly you cannot judge it properly, for all the several buildings and castings down, all the dispensations of his providence from the beginning to the end, they are all made up of but one work. And when we think upon these as disjoined events, and limit our considerations within the bounds of our own time, can we rightly apprehend it? Nay, which is worse? We are used to having no more within the compass of our thought but some present thing. And how much more do we err then? What beauty, what perfection can such a small part have? But it is present to him who beholds with a glance all these parts. Though succeeding in many generations, he sees it all together, joins the end with the beginning, sees the first mold, the first foundation stone, and the last, completing, all flowing from himself, returning thither, and ending in himself. He has made an interchange in nature, which might teach us. The night alone has no beauty, nay, but it beautifies the day. Your darkest hours and tempests, public and personal, are they perfect works? Yes, certainly, if you compound them with your sunshines and calms. Several colors to make pictures beautiful. The one is as needful as the other. And if you did consider your profit more than your honor and pleasure, you would say so. He does not model his works according to our fancy to please us, but for our good to profit us. And he is wiser than we are. And so then it is possible that the most perfect work in itself displeases us most. Therefore you should judge of his dealing by another rule than your own satisfaction. If he spared the rod, he would hate us indeed. Fond love is real hatred. Proverbs 13, verse 24, and Hebrews 12, verse 6. Christians, if you would judge his works by his word and not by your sense, by your wellness and not by your will, certainly we would say, as did the men of Christ, he hath done all well. Mark 7, verse 37. The world would reveal to you a perfection even in imperfection, a perfection in infirmities, that you should not only rejoice in them, but glory in them. Most gladly, therefore, I rather glory in my infirmities, said Paul. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9. Are infirmities a perfect work, or is the suffering of Paul to be buffeted and tempted a perfect work? What comfort is in it? Yes, much. Infirmities alone are infirmities indeed, but infirmities in me and strength in Jesus, weakness in me and strength dwelling in me, these make up one perfect work that could as little want the infirmities as the strength. The glory of God and our wellness and consolation require the one as well as the other. They could not be complete without any of them. What do you think of the times now? Are England's apostasy and Ireland's desolation perfect works? That great work of reformation that seemed to be above our shoulders is now raised to the ground and the very foundations removed. Is deformation a perfect work? Certainly, if we look on these things in the Scripture's light and consider them in relation to Him who is the chief builder and does in heaven and earth what He pleases, that deformation is a perfect work, though not a perfect reformation. Though we could not inform you of the perfection of it, yet the general might silence us. All this shall be no miss, no mar in the end. His work, at the end of accounts, shall appear so complete that it will be as if it had never had interruption. He is wise and knows what he does. If this were not for his glory and his people's good, certainly it should not be. Were not the people wandering in the wilderness 40 years a most strange work, a longer interruption of the expected and begun voyage out of Egypt? What human reason would have styled this work with perfection? Did they not often murmur against it? Yet Moses calls this a perfect work also. What if the Lord is digging the ground deeper in England so that the foundation may be surer? What if he is on a work of judgment, filling the cup of many deluded blasphemers, that he may have another cup of wrath prepared? What if this is his great purpose, to execute vengeance upon a profane generation that will not abide the very name and form of godliness by those who pretend to the name of it as their honor? What if the Lord has defaced all that his kingdom was instrumental in building up in England, that he alone may have the glory in a second temple more glorious? There may be things in his mind. There may be many things in his mind. And he is in one mind. And who can turn him? And what his soul desireth, even that he doeth. Job 23, verse 13. And this may be enough to satisfy us. He sees and knows all his works from the beginning. And without all controversy, he has provided it so, that the reproach of his name shall be made up with the greater shining of his glory, and that the afflictions of his people shall be compensated with songs of deliverance. Will you not give him as much credit as you would to a skillful man in his own trade? You know it is his name, excellent in counsel and wonderful in working, Isaiah 28, verse 29. Then take his work, expound it according to his word, and not according to your own apprehension. It may be that his work appears not excellent, nay, but if you knew his counsel, you would think it so. His wonderful counsel makes all his works excellent, and therefore do not take it upon yourself to judge his works unless you can wade the depth of his counsels, lest you declare yourselves to be both ignorant and presumptuous. There is a time to build, and a time to cast down, a time for everything, said the wise man, Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 through 8. Now, I say, he knows the time and season. He does everything in his time. If you come by a workman that is casting down a house that in your appearance seems good, would you condemn him presently? No. But stay until you see what he will do next. Wait until the due time, and when you see a better piece of workmanship on that ground, you shall absolve him. Though God often changes his work, do not think he changes his counsel and purposes as men do. No, He is in one mind, and who can turn him? Job 23, verse 13. Therefore, he had that change in his mind when he made the work. When he erected such a throne, he had it in his mind to cast it down within such a space. And so his change, his throwing down, is as perfect in his mind as his building up. You have large and big apprehensions of temporal kingdoms and crowns of government and such like, as if they were great, yea, the only things, but they are not so to him. All this world and its standing, all the kingdoms and their affairs, are not his great work and business. He has a great work, the bringing of many sons to glory, and the completing of Jesus Christ. The building of that glorious mystical building, the holy temple, made up of living stones, of which Christ is both the foundation and chief cornerstone. And it is this that he attends to most. Other works among men, though they have more noise, are of less concern. All these are but in the by, and are subservient to his great design, like the scaffolds of a building that are sometimes very needful. Nay, but when the building is completed, he shall remove all of these, and he has no more use of them. Kings shall be your nursery fathers. Kings shall bow to you. He is not much concerned in government, nor in governors, but for his little flock's sake. And if these were gathered, all these shall have an end, but the flock alone shall abide forever. And all his ways are judgment, Deuteronomy 32, verse 4. This is to the same purpose. His ways and his works are one. And this is the perfection of his work, that it is all right and equal. Whether they are in justice or mercy, they are all righteous and holy, with no iniquity in them. His ways are straight and equal, and as exact as if they were measured by an exact, even rule. But because we make application of a crooked rule to them, we do imagine that they are crooked, even as the blind man judges there to be no light because he sees it not. How may the Lord contend and plead with us, as with that people, Ezekiel 18, verse 25? Is it possible that any can challenge him and clear themselves, who will be justified of all when he is judged, and before whom no flesh can be justified? And yet behold, the iniquity of men's hearts. There is a secret reflection of our spirits upon his majesty, as if his ways were not equal whenever we repine against them. And when we do not take with our iniquity and stop with our mouths with dust. Behold, the Lord will assert his own ways and plead with all flesh this controversy, that all his proceedings are full of equity. He walks according to a rule, though he is not tied to a rule. He walks according to the rules of wisdom, justice, and mercy, though his limitless sovereignty might be a sufficient ground of clearing of all his proceedings. But we walk not according to a rule, though we are bound to a rule, and a rule full of equity. Here is the equity and justice of his ways. The gospel holds it forth in a twofold consideration. Number one, first, if any man turns from his iniquity and flees unto my son as the city of refuge, he shall live. He has eternal life. Iniquity shall not be his ruin, although he has done iniquity. Oh, who is a God like unto thee that pardoneth iniquity. Micah 7, verse 18. Is this not complete mercy? Whatever iniquity has been, aggravate it as you can. Though it could have ruined a world, yet it could not have ruined him that turns to Jesus Christ from iniquity. What exception can all the world take against this, or his walking according to it? Number two. And on the other hand, Whosoever continues in sin, though he appears to himself and to others as eminently righteous, if he entertains and loves any known sin and will not part with it for Jesus Christ, shall not he die in his iniquity? Is there any iniquity in this, that he receives the wages of his works, his reward being that he eats of the fruit of his own ways and drinks of his own devices? But how many hearts censure this way as a rigid, strict, and severe dealing? The multitude think it cruelty to condemn any Christian soul, to put so many in hell. The civil man will think it is too hard a measure that he should be ranked in hell with the profane. But certainly all mouths shall be stopped one day, and he shall be justified when he judges. You that will not justify him in his sayings and set to your seal the truth of the word, you shall be constrained to justify him when he executes that sentence. You shall precipitate your own sentence, and rather wonder at his clemency in permitting you to go on in sin for such a long time. This way of the Lord is equal and right in itself, but it is not so to everyone. The just man shall walk in it and not stumble, as in an even way. Nothing shall offend him. Hosea 14, verse 9. Yet for as equal and straight as it is, many other transgressors shall fall therein. They stumble even in the noonday and highway, where there is no offense. It is true, often his own people stumble in it, as David did. Psalm 73, verses 2 through 3. Psalm 94, verses 18 through 19. David's foot was slipping, yet a secret hold was given by God's mercy. It often requires a wise and prudent man to understand it, because his footsteps are in the deep waters, Psalm 77, verse 19. His way is in the depths of the sea, his paths in great waters, so that men must wait until the Lord expounds his own ways, until he comes out of the waters and makes them a dry plain. And this is our advantage. The word says, he is near thee in thy mouth, and neither above nor beneath in the depths, that thou needest neither descend nor ascend to know it. Deuteronomy 30, verses 11 through 14. But his way is in the depths, and his footsteps are not known, so that we might hold ourselves by the word until he expounds his work. His word will teach us our duty, and we may commit unto him his own way. The word is a commentary to expound his ways. David lost the sight of God's footsteps and was prone to wander until he came to the sanctuary, and this shined as a candle in a dark place. There he learned to know the unknown footsteps and to follow them. By all means, embrace the word and be satisfied with it when you do not comprehend his work. It teaches as much in general as may put us to quietness. All his ways are judgment, just, and true. In all his ways is the King of Saints. If I do not comprehend how it is no wonder, for he makes darkness his covering. He spreads over his most curious engines and pieces of workmanship a veil of darkness for a season. And who can behold him when he hides himself, says Job, Job 23, verse 9. And though he withdraws the covering, yet what am I? Who can, by searching, find out God, Job 11, verse 7. If I shall examine his way, what rule shall I take to try it by? If I measure by my shallow capacity or by my crooked way, Shall I have any just account of it? Will my arm measure the heavens as his does? If I examine it or try it by himself, he is as high as heaven and unsearchable. Therefore it becomes us to hearken to his word and believe its sentence of his work when reason cannot comprehend it. One thing, if it were deeply engraved on our hearts, would be a principle to settle our spirits in all the mysteries and riddles of providence, the knowledge and faith of his sovereignty, of his highness, and of his wisdom. Should he give account of his matters to us? He is wise and knows his works, but is he bound to make us know them? His ways are above our thoughts and ways, as heaven is above the earth, Isaiah 55, verses 8 through 9. And therefore, O grasshopper, upon the earth that dwells in tabernacles of clay, do not presume to model his ways according to your conceptions. One thing is certain, this is enough for faith. All his ways are mercy and truth to those that keep his covenant and his testimonies, Psalm 25, verse 10. And there is no way or path of God so far above our reach and so unsearchable as his mercy in pardoning sin. And this is only the satisfying answer to all your objections and scruples. In these you do but vent your own thoughts. But the Lord says, my thoughts are above your thoughts, as heaven above earth, Isaiah 55, verses 8 through 9. Ye but speak of your own ways, but my ways are far above yours. They are not measured by your iniquity. And therefore, David subjoins, pardon my iniquity, for it is great, Psalm 25, verse 11.